Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here. Stand to reason. Thank you for being part of our show. And, you know, I did not mention in the last segment, the last broadcast, which was just a few minutes ago for me, but a couple days ago for you who are receiving the podcast, that we are moving ahead of pace with our student conferences. And that's our new name for what we've been doing for years. The student conference, for example, in Southern California, coming up in September 25th and 26th in Costa Mesa. Early bird pricing ends August 1st, so you can go to realityapologetics.com to register. And for further details, we also have be opening up a reality in the Seattle area and here we go again. Bellingham, is that it? I get them mixed up. There's two B's up there. Is that right? Bedlam. No, Bedlam someplace else. Bellingham. Okay, I got it right. And that's going to be in October, towards the end of October. So we're opening up the Pacific Northwest. And then in November, again, we'll be in Minneapolis, St. Paul. What?
Bellevue.
Okay, see? I trusted you, brother. See, it's so close. But yeah, it only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades, right? No, missed it by that much. So Bellevue is where we're going to be holding our event. And you can get all that information at realityapologetics.com. Of course, in the spring then, we'll be in Dallas. So we're just moving ahead of pace. No, regardless, I mean, things are opening up, so it looks like it's going to work out for us. And we'll see what the Lord does. But love to have you participate in that. It's a magnificent series of conferences. This one coming up is going to be about truth. Truth is not ice cream, which is kind of a takeoff on a relativism idea. Truth isn't just your flavor. It's more insulin, right? Okay. So that's the broad theme. And we'll have our normal cast of characters. I don't have the list here, but they're going to be superb, fabulous, fantastic. Always are. So love for you to be a part of that. And incidentally, we are still looking for a South Southeast 2021 Conference Center, a church that will sponsor that. And if you attend or work at a large church that's interested in hosting us, that wants to work with us, we know how to do this. We've been doing it for a long time. But the heavy lifting is done by the local church, but we guide the lift. So we tell you how to do it. And these events have had a tremendous impact on the local community, not to speak of the local church itself that sponsors it. So we have been in Birmingham for the last number of years, and we're still looking for a home. Could be Birmingham, could be Atlanta, could be Montgomery, could be Nashville, could be Memphis, somewhere in the in the South Southeast for 2021. So if you're interested, if you have some ideas there, Danielle, Danielle, at str.org, Danielle, at str.org is the person to get in touch with. Okay. So let's go right to Oliver. And, of course, when I say, oh, gosh, I can't believe it. I am so sorry, Oliver. I just hit the red button instead of the flashing green button. And Oliver went away. But Oliver's going to call right back because he knows I'm such an idiot and the mistake I just made. Oliver had been waiting on for over an hour. And I was going to make a joke about, oh, please come back, Oliver. I was going to make a joke about, now we're going right to Oliver. Yeah, right to him an hour after he calls. Oh, there it's ringing. Line one. Please be you, Oliver. I always feel like such a dweeb when I do this. And we'll see if it is. If it is he or he is it, the one calling. See, the person who's answering the phone is not in this building. She's in another zip code. She's in another county. Oliver's calling back. Okay, great. He's on hold. I can go right to Oliver. Okay, push this. Get the right. Oliver, I'm so sorry.
Oh, sorry. I thought I hit the hang up button by accident or something.
Oh, I did. Oh, well, you should listen to the recording, because I'm beating my breast the whole time you were gone. Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea culpa. And I was going to say, and now we'll go right to Oliver. And I was going to make a joke. Yeah, right to you after an hour that you've been on the air. And then I pushed the button and flushed you down, man. You were gone. Thank you for calling.
I can't believe you hung up on me.
Oh, so my apologies, and I'm glad we're back.
That's all right.
Because you have an interesting question.
Yeah, my question is, so recently there have been more studies into this whole Neanderthal-human interbreeding thing.
Right.
In the past, they thought that it was, like, it affected us, like, our genes, like, our hair, skin color. Recent studies show that it's kind of neutral DNA, but it still shows, there's still evidence that we interbred with them. Is there a problem with that biblically?
It depends how one looks at it and how one interprets that evidence. And I am aware that there is genetic evidence that we have in our genome currently, in the current human genome, we have evidence of a Neanderthal's kind of genes, and so that indicates they were interbreeding. For a while there, I think the conventional wisdom was that Neanderthals were not humans because they couldn't interbreed with them. That was the thinking, and that's kind of the measure, the ability to interbreed, that you're kind of the same thing. Now, keep in mind, like things like species, stuff like that, these are human constructs. Kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. These aren't dropped out of heaven somewhere. They aren't, in a sense, certain sense, strict scientific categories. There are ways that human beings have organized things of similar kind. And so that if it turns out that two things that were considered not the same species, i.e. couldn't interbreed, and then it turns out that they did interbreed, well, that just shows the liability of our classifying system, that's all.
Yeah.
So just something to keep in mind there. Now, the person who's been doing quite a bit of work on this is William Lane Craig. And, you know, when he goes after a topic, he really goes in deep. I think he spent like 5 years studying the aseity of God, and most people don't even know what that means. But now he's working on the human origins, and he's trying to figure out a way of reconciling, or I mean not reconciling, of finding a marriage between the most reliable scientific evidence and which, by the way, is in a class by itself. It's hard to know what's reliable. Okay, because you can have a body of information for which there are multiple interpretations.
Mm-hmm.
And the information is the information. But the interpretation is a matter of interpretation, right? So it could go this way, it could go that way, depending. And it's just good to be aware of all this. Now, Bill Craig is a very careful guy and very committed to orthodoxy, and he is. And I think what he's it's interesting to watch the process. So if you go to is it reasonablefaith.com?
Is it Defenders class? Yeah,
the Defenders class is one vehicle of teaching that he uses, and he talks about this. Reasonable Faith is his organization. ReasonableFaith.org is his website, and so I suggest you go there. He talks about it on occasion on his podcast, and I listen to his podcast. Actually, not so much recently because I haven't been taking the long drive home from work in the last 3 months, or to the airport to take trips usually. But I've been listening to some of his stuff, you know, and I think that. So my understanding now is that there does seem to be evidence of interbreeding between Neanderthals and what we would call now modern humans, such that there is a mixture in our current genome. But a lot depends on definition here. So what does one mean by a human? Okay. Now, as far as I'm concerned theologically, a human is a descendant of Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
Okay, because that's the human race. Now, there were lots of descendants of Adam and Eve. I mean, you have two, then you have four, then you have eight, then you have 16. You know how that works. It's multiplication, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they populate the earth, okay? And when you have what's called speciation, when groups kind of get isolated in certain areas, and then you have certain characteristics that predominate of that predominate that group, like brown hair, brown eyes, dark skin, or blue eyes, light hair, light skin, that kind of thing. Well, you're going to get these. You're going to get lots of variation in human populations, and so. I don't see the problem at this point with understanding some of these ancient hominids that are human-like to be variations of humans that have, as a group, have disappeared. Think of pygmies in Africa, for example. I mean, those are human beings that have are very specific characteristics bodily that are different than the other human groups in other places. So you could imagine someone, a group like that dying off for some reason. So there's no more pygmies, but there'd still be humans. There might be groups of humans that go extinct in a certain sense as per their unique kind, but they're still humans, and the human race continues on. So I am certainly open to the possibility that Cro-Magnon man and Neanderthal and Swanscombe and whatever the other ones are, Heidelberg man, these are quite possibly true human beings and descendants of Adam and Eve that kind of went off in their own direction genetically because they got isolated populations. And therefore, you're going to see interbreeding there. Okay. Another way of understanding it is that you have true human beings, descendants of Adam and Eve, in my view, who then interbreed with other hominid creatures that are human-like, but not true humans, but enough like humans to interbreed with, which strikes me as a little bit weird. But, I mean, God didn't make the standard that a species is someone that, you can't interbreed outside of. That's just, like, again, that's a way of defining it in a human way. It might be that human beings can actually have procreate with other creatures that are very similar to them genetically and physiologically. I don't know the answer to that. I'm just thinking in terms of possibilities. So it could be then that you have true men descending from Adam, and then you have others like, say, maybe Neanderthal, who is not descended from Adam but is an advanced hominid creature because God made lots of kinds of things and had the capability of interbreeding, and therefore we're going to show some of that DNA is going to show up in the human genome now.
Yeah. I think I agree more with the second one, I guess. It's that's weird. But, the first three you're talking about with Neanderthals, like, could be humans, it sounded like you were saying.
The first one is that you could have the human race that is variegated. So you have groups, like I mentioned, pygmies, that are very different from other groups, but they're true humans, then they could interbreed. Okay, so if pygmies had a well-defined genome, you're going to find, if there was interbreeding, evidence of that genome leaking into the genome of other human being groups.
Okay.
So I'm speculating at this point. I'm using that as an example of how it might happen, but I don't know. And this is what Bill has done a lot of work with.
Okay. So, well, thank you, Greg.
Yeah, I suggest that you take a look at what Bill Craig's been doing. I guarantee he's going to be writing something on it. You know, that's just him, the way he does things. And he's really good about these things, and I have a high opinion of him. I've known him many, many years, and we've worked together in many, many things. So, and so our organizations have as well. So I don't agree with him on a number of things, but that's irrelevant. It's discussion within the community. It's an intranicene differences, you know what I mean? It's a intramural kind of differences. And so that's okay. All righty.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Okay, Oliver, thank you so much for your patience and for putting up with my blundering here at the beginning of the show. All right?
Have a good one.
Okay, all the best to you. Bye.
Thank you.
Yeah,
bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Wow. Okay, I'm glad he called back. And there is a lot of work that's being done in this area, and there is a lot of speculation on how this works. I like to go to the Discovery Institute. I know those guys, a lot of them, and I trust them. I trust their intellectual integrity, their biblical integrity, their personal integrity. They're good thinkers, and they are deeply committed to a biblical account of the origin of man. That is, that Adam and Eve are distinctive beings created by God and are not the process of an evolutionary series of events. And part of the reason they say that is because they give very powerful evidence that the Darwinian model on its own merits does not work. And, in fact, I saw Paul Nelson and Stephen Meyer in San Diego in November at ETS, and Bill Craig was there too at this panel discussion, but their whole tack was with regards to theistic evolution, if evolution fails on the merits, then there's no reason to marry our theology with it. Okay, it's like polishing the brass on the Titanic. And I'm convinced that that's the case. That Darwinian evolution cannot do the work that it purported to do. That naturalistic, unguided, non-designed process that did not have us in mind, famous quote, can actually produce the complexity. Never mind the biological realm, even the most simple cells. So, as if any cell is simple. They're not. That's the point. And the more I look around the world, we've been watching hummingbirds. When I was in Wisconsin last week, there are hummingbirds flying around my brother's head because he's got a red bandana on. And hummingbirds, I think they're the only bird that can fly forward, fly backwards, and hover. They have this unbelievable capability. There's a video that I saw called Flight, and you can get it. It's magnificent. And we sell it here. Yeah, that's right. And so, and when you look at that, that's just one of a series, by the way. Living Waters is in that series. Metamorphosis about butterflies is in that series. But when those hummingbirds were hovering in front of my brother's face, their wings were beating so fast that you couldn't see them, and their head was not moving one bit. And that all happened by accident. Small incremental changes. No, come on. Really? All you have to do is observe the natural realm. And if you're not utterly biased to a naturalistic explanation, you would never buy that kind of nonsense. Anyway, though, so this is the way the Discovery Institute has approached the issue. And they realize, when you look at the merits and the demerits, it's not an option, the Darwinian model, okay? So then it's beholden upon Christians to offer a model that makes sense of all of the evidence and still is in accordance with the biblical teaching, which seems fairly straightforward, out of Genesis 2 on the origin of man, humans, that is. So, and that's the trick. And there are ways of understanding the genetics, all the genetic facts, as opposed to the interpretations of the facts. There are ways of understanding those facts that are consistent with the biblical model, with an original male and original female, an original Adam and an original Eve. They even use this language in the parlance of the field, mitochondrial Eve. Adam's got his own little handle there, too. I can't remember what it is. Incidentally, John is a Heiser now. Yeah, I hope he's not listening because he's going to say, I had dinner with you in November, and now you can't remember my name. It's called the Hidden Realm. Does that sound right? Derek is looking it up right now. So John Heiser, a really fascinating conversation with him. And I am looking forward to reading the book. I've just started about 3 months ago, and then I haven't gotten through it. I'm actually reading, believe it or not, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, which is 1,000 pages. The Unseen Realm, thank you. The Unseen Realm, Michael Heiser, H-E-I-S-S-E-R. Well, I was worried that John Heiser was listening, and I guarantee you he was not. But Michael might have been. But that book has been recommended to me by so many people, including board members, that I seriously have thought about getting it. And then when I met him and listened to his characterization of some unusual passages in Scripture, unusual only because it's been difficult for people to understand how to take them, and then he kind of constructs this theological understanding that solves a whole bunch of problems. And it has to do with angelic beings that are part of the real world that God that's part of God's, in a certain sense, counsel. He uses them for certain purposes. And you read about this in Psalms. So I wanted to, I don't have any callers right now, but I don't want to sacrifice the rest of the hour. So I wanted to offer some information about, in response to some questions that I have been asked in the past. I was a guest apologist for Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, RZIM, a few months back. And people asked me questions, and I wrote out answers and posted them, and that was kind of fun. But I thought I'd offer some thoughts to you. here's a question that was asked about engaging college students, and it's that I thought about, and maybe this will be helpful to you. there has been quite a bit lately of high-profile deconversion of Christians, deconversion stories and stuff, and maybe later in the year we'll talk more about this as an organization and maybe do a solid ground about that, or not, I'm not sure, but because I think much could be said about that. But the question I was asked here, with your years of engaging with college students, what are the top three reasons why Christians fall out from their faith or choose another religion or be an atheist? And how can we help them get back with Christ? Now, I mentioned to him, though, and I'll say to you, though I've spoken on more than 85 college campuses to date, most of my information about that thing is secondhand. Because I go onto campuses and give a talk and then field questions does not mean that I have my finger on the pulse of why Christian students are leaving Christianity. I find that out when a Christian person leaves Christianity, writes an article about it, and tells, you know, some of the reasons why. So it isn't like I've got all this insight into that question. What would be someone who had better insight on that would be maybe someone from a campus group, a crew or InterVarsity or something like that, who is interacting, Ratio Christi, interacting a lot with Christians or people who formerly were Christian and now have deconverted. And they could tell you what the reasons are. It isn't like I've engaged a lot of deconversion of former Christians. And it's only that from the pieces they've written and from some polls that address the issue, I have a little bit of sense of things that are going on. So that with that qualifier, I then explain that I think that principally Christians that lose their faith, this is my suspicion, and there's some evidence to bear this out, never had much confidence in it to begin with. Now, okay, that sounds like they weren't really believers, so they didn't really lose their faith because they never had a faith. Well, that's not exactly what I'm saying, and I'm not trying to take a weenie way out. But I think that there are, let me back up, 12, 15 years ago when Frank Turk and I started doing CIA, actually, to put it more precisely and accurately, when Frank started doing CIA and he asked me to speak for him, I mean, it's his project, not our project, there was this sense that, well, people are losing their faith in college. But we have both learned since then that people who defect in college actually lost their convictions or the strength of their convictions while they were still in high school. So it's just that when they moved away from their support groups and they moved away from the spiritual leadership around them and their larger community that made it easier to do the Christian thing, and into an environment where you didn't have all those supports, you don't have those incentives, and you don't have all those people who believe like you believe, but believe just the opposite. And there's a lot of candy to be had, so to speak, for defecting. You know, when you're 18, you're not really that interested in thinking about God and purity and, you know, all of that. You want to, you know, sow some wild oats. So all those things are going on. And if there is not a good solid foundation when a young person leaves for college, they are easily going to become a casualty because, in a certain sense, they already have been a casualty. Okay? So this is why I say I think they never had much confidence in it to begin with. They might have done all the right things, but they were not equipped to know why Christianity was true. And so this is one of the reasons that we do Rethink, or what we call now Reality, because we want to stem the tide early on. And Reality is focusing on high school and middle schoolers, and successfully as well. And we're also putting together training. I just was filming today for that. Online training that is meant, it's geared for the students that come out of Reality, but anybody can do it, to build a foundation in the essentials, not only in the essentials of Christianity, like the story of Reality, but essentials in engaging, like tactics, or the essentials in dealing with particular issues that are critical and important. Okay, so the current data then shows that those who jettison Christianity in college have already begun to fade in junior high and high school, but go public when they enter a secular environment at the academy. So we lose them early while they're still in church under our watch. Well, that's painful. But their chief general reason for dropping out is this, and we just know this from Paul's. I'm kind of summing up a bunch of things. The questions they asked in church as teenagers were never answered. And often were never even welcome. And by the way, I know there are people that are listening here that have had this experience. I was asking questions, and I was told not to ask the questions. Just have faith, brother. Well, that's not going to work. It just doesn't. I mean, on balance, it's not going to work. Because real questions reflect real concerns and often real doubts that are legitimate challenges to be met. And we have the answers. We have a deep bench. One of the things that Stand to Reason has, I think, demonstrated, not just from STR, but from all the people that we interact with, the broader community of apologetics folk, that, man, there's hardly a challenge that has not been legitimately and adequately answered. Okay, so we've got a deep bench, we've got the answers, to put it simply, but a lot of young people don't know what those answers are. And by the way, a lot of churches, I mean, to be fair, are not equipped to answer them. This is why I write about this in the end of the Tactics book, that might be a good idea if you are interested in apologetics in a church that doesn't have that interest so much, that you be that resource person for the church. You find the other dry tinder, if you're able, that is the other people of kindred spirit, and then you kind of huddle together and get a spark going and you start a little fire. And you know like how fires work when you have some dry tinder and a lot of wet wood. If you get a small fire going, then the fire starts to thaw out, dry out the other wood, and then you get a larger burn. And that's what oftentimes happens. So you could be that go-to person that your pastor can recommend other people to who might have the answers. And where do you get the answers? Well, that's why we're here, and a lot of other organizations as well. But there are like boku books out there dealing with everything. In fact, I've been asked by my agent and my publisher, you know, and what's next? What are you going to write? Well, I can't do a general apologetics book because there's so many of them already out there. I don't have anything new to say in that sense. Doesn't mean I won't be doing more writing, but the point is that there's lots of good stuff that's available. So there's no good reason why churches shouldn't be at least in a position to direct their young people with questions to resources that can help answer those questions. That's what I'm getting at. And therefore, that will begin to take the edge off the general reason that most students are dropping out, that their questions aren't being answered, that they have no good evidence that Christianity is actually true. And so they had no good reason to stick with it when the cultural pressure in the university pushes them away from Christianity rather than towards it. Okay, so there's another issue, too, that might initially surprise you until you think about it a moment. And I can't even remember who gave me this thought or this idea or got, but I hadn't thought about it. And then when the person said it, it made perfect sense. And I've already alluded to it a little bit. And that is sex. I mean, it's much easier to follow the rules when friends and family and youth leaders are looking over your shoulder. But if you move hundreds or even thousands of miles away, everything changes. There are few external incentives that are encouraging the Christian to be virtuous. In fact, just the opposite. And to complicate matters, a recent refrain from non-Christians is that if God exists, he can't be good since he's crimping their sexual style. No, God's got to allow me to do whatever I want sexually, or else he can't be good. And so, you know, our young people are kind of caught crossways there with the challenge and then also with the issue themselves, the moral issue themselves. And I remember many years ago, my pastor, Zach, Hope Chapel, Hermosa Beach, mentioned that he was talking with somebody who he knew that refused to be a Christian, and he just asked him straight out, is there some moral issue in your life that's keeping you from considering Christ? Well, that's pretty bold, but it's on target for a lot of people. They aren't going to think about Christ, God, Jesus, repentance, because there's just too much sin that they're enjoying. And I don't remember what the answer was from the guy, but notice the question, though. That's oftentimes the issue. And that is a big issue, I think, with young people. Okay? God can't be good since he doesn't allow us to satisfy our sexual impulses, however varied they might be, and at will. So it's compelling for young people who are looking for love in all the wrong places to be taken in by that argument. One last thing that I'll mention, a significant speed bump for college kids, it's actually a host of issues regarding the Bible. So slavery in the Bible, patriarchy, apparent ethnic cleansing. I don't think that was what was going on because people weren't being cleansed, killed because of their ethnicity, but because of their sin. And in fact, God did the same thing to the Jews when they did the same thing the other nations were doing regarding sin. Okay, so it wasn't ethnic cleansing, but anyway, it can be construed as genocide. There are sexual restraints, as I mentioned, that are really unpopular. And I think these are tougher issues because they require a big picture thinking about God's designs. It requires... the operative word there is thinking, all right? And most people aren't thinking. And so if you have an issue that requires you be thoughtful to see the connections of things, to know what's right and what's good and what's true. But you're not thoughtful about those things, then you're not going to see the connections. And I think this is the circumstance here to see all of this interwoven stuff that we see in the Old Testament. There's bigger things involved here. And it's just harder to navigate that. And so, consequently, those kinds of issues are big for young people. They require an understanding of both the purpose of the Mosaic Law, for example, understanding the prevailing cultural conditions in the ancient Near East that the law was speaking into and was in many cases improving. So those are some of the reasons I think that, you know, people just simply fall away in that environment, right? And the RX, and I'll just kind of close the show here with this thought. The RX is good theology, accurate Christian worldview, and good reasons why the Christian worldview is actually true. That is, our story of reality is in fact the true story of reality, and that we have, and that's what Standard Reason is committed to giving to you, as we have for 27 years and will still do so. Okay. So thank you for spending this shortened time here a little bit with me on the show. And not sure who's filling in the next few weeks. Maybe I am. I am. Is that right? Oh, okay. So you'll hear my voice for the next few weeks, but I'm not going to be here. These are shows in the can. Greg Kokel here for Stand the Reason. Give him a hand. Bye-bye.